So good evening. It's a real pleasure to be here to speak at the last Foundation lecture of the year and to have this opportunity to present some of the work that we're doing and some of the underlying thinking about the way that we use science and innovation to advance international development. And science and rigorous science and innovation is critical to development. Historically, some of the major advancements in development have been driven by science, be it the investment, new medicines, new vaccines, the Green Revolution. They've all contributed to the historical successes and reductions, improvements in life expectancy that we've seen around the world. If you look at what are the challenges that face us globally and face the developing world most harshly, they're multiple and continually changing. So here, I just have photos up of some of the areas within our research portfolio that we're thinking about. They're huge and complex, things like conflict, population growth. By 2030, our population will have increased to 8.5 billion. So we have to face the challenges of how do we feed that size of that population? How do we house that population? How do we ensure an improved standard of living without decimating the environment and contributing to climate change? We see ever-growing urbanization. By 2030, 60% of the world's population will be living in cities, so that's more than 6 billion people will be in cities. We will continue to have poverty and inequality, with that poverty and inequality increasingly focused in the most fragile and conflict-affected states. We'll be having to respond to more extremes in climate, both severe weather events, both droughts and floods. We'll have to continue to strengthen our response to the migrant crises and say, how do we effectively tackle these issues at source? We will need to continue to respond effectively both to the diseases that continue to plague our world, be it neglected tropical diseases that still affect almost a billion people, through to new disease outbreaks. So diseases such as Ebola or more recently Zika that emerged with a particularly harsh impact on children, the link with Zika and microcephaly. We have to tackle fundamental issues around inequality, such as gender inequality. Approximately 1 in 3 women around the world will experience sexual or physical violence in their life. If we're going to achieve inclusive development, we need to tackle this issue head on. And we need to tackle issues such as increased drug resistance. So, for example, in malaria, we've had huge impacts on malaria. These gains threaten to be reversed with the increase in drug resistance, the potential for drug resistance. So in terms of the strategy that influences how DFID invests its research money, we're very centrally informed by the UK ODA strategy. So that ODA strategy maps out 4 main objectives: strengthening global peace, security and governance, strengthening resilience and responses to crises, promoting global prosperity, and tackling extreme poverty and helping the most vulnerable. As we're thinking about how to use taxpayers' money, we also need to make sure in those investments that we're achieving good value for money and that we're really looking very carefully at how can we achieve these objectives in a way that uses resources well. So when you look at those objectives, I get asked, well, what is the role of research? What is the role of science and evidence? And the ODA strategy very explicitly gives a very strong commitment to the need to ensure that we use rigorous evidence to underpin our spending decisions. And there's a very explicit recognition as well that the effective responses to the major development challenges, such as the ones I've just been covering, will require that we generate rigorous, operationally focused evidence. Last month, DFID launched its research review. So what this document does its outline, what are the areas that DFID in its research budget will focus on? And DFID, and what was important about this strategy, which was launched by the Secretary of State, was really the renewing of the commitment to DFID's investment in science, in research and evidence. So DFID invests approximately £390 million per year in supporting research. And the aim of that research is really to tackle the most pressing and difficult problems. In this strategy, the main directions that we outline are that we will, in this spending period, continue and scale up our work on infectious diseases. So that's linked to the Ross Fund and the manifesto commitments reflected there. We will double our research on humanitarian innovation. We will treble our research funding in education. And we will increase funding on climate, energy, and water. We will also seek to produce new syntheses and research on migration, on cities, and on adolescents, so on those some of the major cross-cutting issues that the development community it needs to be better able to respond to. And we will expand our research footprint in the MENA region. In this research document, we also outline some of the shifts in thinking. And one of the areas that we're discussing very actively with colleagues in other government departments is how do we get better at thinking about supporting capacity building in the developing world? And particularly, how do we invest in ways that will strengthen national level abilities and capabilities to use research to answer their own development challenges? And I think not only with DFID's research money, but with the other research funding that's coming through the Newton Fund, through the Global Challenges Research Fund, and other government departments, there's a real opportunity for us to join up and say, are there ways that in the partnerships that we're forming with the developing world, that we can ensure that we're strengthening national level systems to be able to generate and use evidence as they move forward on their own trajectories of development? And more broadly, we're now in a situation where, as well as the DFID research funding, we also have substantial resources for research across other government departments, including the £1.5 billion for the Global Challenges Research Fund. So there's a lot of opportunity for us to join up across government and say, what are the skills and expertise and opportunities that each department brings to tackling these very complex development challenges, and how do we join up in a coordinated research agenda moving forward? So the other question I get asked in terms of when we're thinking about strategically, what are the priority research questions and what are the areas that DFID prioritises, how does DFID make its decision making? We basically ask ourselves five questions. So the first is, when we're thinking about what are the priority areas, is the direction that we're focusing our research resources on really tackling one of the big development challenges, and really focused on the practical realities of what will help lead to impact on the ground if we commission that research? The other thing that we do quite carefully before we invest in any area of research is saying, well, what does the research funding landscape look like? So will our investment address an important gap where, for example, other donors aren't investing? So, for example, our research investments on tackling violence against women very, very much fall into that category, where there wasn't much research to say, how do we prevent violence? And so DFID stepped in and really sort of paved the way in leading on that. Three, two areas, for example, in some of our investments in new health technologies, where we recognise that we need quite large sums of investment to have a healthy pipeline of new vaccines or new diagnostics or new treatments, and where we pool resources with other donors that are interested in those issues. So, for example, the Wellcome Trust or the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. We're interested in applied research, we're interested in practical research, but also we want research that is very high quality, because we very strongly believe that it's only by doing the best quality research that we'll really be able to get the insights that will help us move forward in terms of tackling development challenges. We are very much trying to look at research where we can see the pathway and how that research might translate into real impact. And so that we can see the potential deliverability if of the potential findings of the research that we're investing in. And lastly, that we have the potential through those investments to have a large return on the resources that we're committing to science and research. So that, I hope, gives you a framework on the research and how it's the way that we're thinking about it and how it links to the ODIS strategy within DFID. I now want to talk a little bit about, to give you some examples, to give you a feel of the range of different research and the ways that we're using science in the research, in practice in DFID. So the three examples I want to talk about are firstly on science in emergencies. The second is to give you a couple of examples of rigorous evaluations of innovative interventions. So these are randomized controlled trials of different forms of social intervention. And lastly, and as a lead-in, I think, to some of the discussants' areas of interest, I will talk a little bit about some of the successes that we've had in investing in mobile cash and solar energy. So first, the first example that I think predictably I'm going to talk about in terms of responding to emergencies is the ways that we used different types of research to inform our response to Ebola, the Ebola crisis. And in this situation, science was used at all stages, from the planning to the preparation and the response. And I can see Chris Whitty sitting in the back, who was very much who's my predecessor, who was very much behind commissioning and leading some of the work that fed into the response in practice. And the essential thinking about the response was really driven by the epidemiological thinking about how do we drive the R0, that basic epidemiological measure of how quickly an epidemic takes off, how do we drive that R0 less than 1, which means that epidemic will die out. We use modelling in different ways to predict what is the expected trajectory of the epidemic, but also as we started to get real-time data on what was happening in practice, what are the predictions of weekly cases, and that was used to inform the targeting of intervention responses. Social science was also an area that was very useful in informing the response. And so this picture on the right here is of the graves of many people who died from Ebola. And what the social science helped us think through is how do you implement essentially a very rapid, somewhat militarized response to dealing with an outbreak? How do you do that in a way that is acceptable for communities? How do you get community support for the necessary activities that need to happen? And also social science helped us recognize the particular risks that were happening around burial practices and traditional burial practices, where the practices of washing and preparing the body for burial was putting women, the people who were preparing the bodies, at a high risk of infection. And so the social science enabled us to really say, well, what are ways to respect the culture, respect the rituals of death and burial, but without increasing risk? Research also fed into how do we get better technologies to respond to Ebola? And that includes work on diagnostics and how do we improve the throughput in our labs to make sure that we can make accurate diagnostics more quickly, and also investments in vaccine trials to test the efficacy of vaccine products. We're also using science in other types of emergencies, and one that we've been using in a number of situations is the applications of satellite data. And this slide speaks to an application where we use satellite data to enable us to better predict and respond to extreme weather events and disasters. And so in particular, in response to El Nino in 15-16, the use of satellite modelling and accurate weather projections enabled us to plan ahead to respond effectively to the predicted impacts of El Nino, and in particular, it enabled DFID to mobilise resources quickly to take rapid action in Somalia, and in this case, it supported riverbank reinforcement activities, which prevented many hectares of productive land from being flooded. And this is an area around using satellite data and getting more sophisticated in the way that we predict extreme weather events is something that moving forward we will continue to invest in and also seek to develop financial strategies to ensure that we have the resources able to then respond effectively and quickly to severe events. And I think, again, one of the respondents will speak to that a little bit afterwards. I'm trying to give you a plug and a lead-in. Okay. So that gives you a sense of some of the ways that science has been in emergency responses. There are many examples of that, including in Nepal, we're doing research investments in response to Zika. So, but I hope to see a flavour of the different applications of science and essentially the importance of bringing together multiple disciplines, that it's not one discipline alone that we're often seeking to bring to help us tackle a problem, but a combination of disciplines that help us together identify how best to respond. So the second area I want to move on to is the research investments that we make into getting much more rigorous evidence on what interventions are actually effective. There's a risk in all practice that we continue doing things that we believe work, that we've always done, and we aren't critical enough about, well, actually, do those interventions actually achieve the expected effects? And so DFID funds quite a large portfolio of evaluation research across its health, agriculture, governance, education portfolios. And we also support quite a lot of evidence synthesis, because in the end, what policymakers need isn't just what is the exciting study coming from one particular trial, but what is the body of evidence on this particular topic, and what does that body of evidence tell us about what are the appropriate intervention responses? And so these pitches here are some of the synthesis documents that one of our partners, 3IE, have produced, in this case looking at what we know about how to deliver effective education at scale. A couple of examples that I want to flag up are ones that I particularly enjoy, because it's applying randomized controlled trial methods to intervention subjects that you might not think are amenable to this sort of experimental design. So the first one is a large-scale nudge experiment that was conducted in Rwanda. This was in collaboration with an IDS-led International Centre for Taxation and Development, and in collaboration with the Rwanda Tax Authority. And what that experiment involved was an experiment with 13,000 taxpayers. And what the intervention arm of this study was sent emails, letters, or text. And those messaging media had different types of content. So the sort of control was just a very neutral message. Another arm had a reminder of sanctions, so you'll get fined if you don't pay your tax on time. And the third had a positive message. And so through that randomized controlled trial design, we were able to compare, well, what do we get from essentially a passive follow-up, something that's threatening a punitive response or something that is encouraging a behaviour. And what we saw from that is very clearly that the positive text messages yielded the best results. And I think this finding that we're seeing in Rwanda replicates some of the findings and sort of similar nudge experiments that have been happened in industrialised countries. In terms of return on investment, this study was pretty cheap. It cost us about £90,000. And in terms of increased tax revenue for Rwanda, it gave us a return of about £7 million in increased tax. And tax is a really important issue for development because it's really as part of supporting countries and enabling countries to fund their own pathway out of development to ensure that they can collect tax and have a functioning tax system is an important part of that. And this gives us an insight into ways that you can improve tax revenue. And these results have led to a change policy in practice in Rwanda. Not surprisingly, it's strong evidence that has been taken up by the tax authority, and particularly because they were involved in the outset in the experiment, it makes it very simple for us to move on to that being translated into practice on the ground, and also supported the digitalization of the tax system. Another example comes from a randomized control trial that was conducted in a very difficult situation. So this was a trial to look at how can we provide improved mental health responses in Peshawar in Pakistan. What we know is that the mental health consequences of conflict and violence are wide-ranging and persuasive. And globally, how do we deal with that mental health consequence is important, because today more than 125 million people are directly affected by armed conflict. And so this was a trial that was funded through a funding modality that we run in collaboration with the Wellcome Trust. And it tested the impact of a behavioural intervention that was delivered by lay workers, who were very much recognised the constraints of that health system. And it trained health workers in quite simple group counselling approaches to enable them to work effectively with adults with psychological distress and quite acute manifestations of psychological distress. And what the trial findings show is significant reductions in clinically significant anxiety and depressive symptoms in 3 months. And this work has just recently been published in JAMA. Okay, so now moving on to my third example, which is using digital to create impacts at scale. And across government and within DFID, across all of our different divisions, the opportunities and interest in digital is something that we're all very focused on. And it's an area that we're very excited about the potential that digital can play, both to enable us to deliver development quickly and effectively, but also the way that one digital technology can provide a platform for us to then deliver other digital technologies. And I'm going to illustrate that in the example that I'll show you today. So in 2001, DFID funded some research that noted that airtime was used in Kenya as a virtual currency. And there was interest for a system that where you could retain a cash value in a digital form. And so that led to DFID engaging with innovators in the mobile industry, and it led to the pilot of a mobile money transfer system, and that's M-Pesa. This plot here shows the growth in customers over time in Kenya. So you can see quite a rapid increase in demand and use of M-Pesa in Kenya. And so now M-Pesa is used by about two-thirds of Kenya adults. It's supporting more than 85,000 agents for about 50,000 merchants. It processes daily about 8 million transactions, which total about 20 million. So this mobile money is phenomenal as a technology, and the way that quite quickly within the Kenyan context, it has become widespread. It's in very widespread use. And what's important about this is that this high levels of coverage gives us an opportunity to add other technical innovations that build on that platform to scale up other forms of technology. And in particular, we've had, I think, quite remarkable success in using mobile money to scale up access to solar lighting. And so working with GSMA and the pay-as-you-go platform that could be developed using mobile money, DFID invested in creating a range of different off-grid household solar technologies. And those of you who had tea before this talk will have seen the example of that. But what's interesting also is it hasn't said, well, let's just give people this technology. It's used that pay-as-you-go system to enable consumers who want to access solar technology to enable them to purchase those technologies, but also created new business opportunities by looking at what is the business model that will support and enable small enterprises to develop around the provision and servicing of this mobile technology. And I just want to show you what that looks like in practice. So this is a plot over time of the uptake of Incopa. And you can see that very rapid uptake in the Incopa technology with projections of getting up to 425 million. So the Y-back axis is thousands of units, up to 425 units by the end of this year. We can ask where we are on that.
We passed it.
Excellent. This red area shows, so essentially purchasers will pay a low unit cost for a year and then they own the unit. And so this red area shows the number of units that are owned. And then this blue area shows the areas where there is ongoing partial ownership of those units. What those green diamonds show is the investments that DFID made. So essentially, you can see our investments were made very early on in this trajectory. So we invested in is this technology something that has potential that could be used in very resource-poor settings that might be something that's of interest? We then invested in what is the business model that might work to create new business opportunities but that will allow this technology to scale. And then you can see after this that the coverage that's achieved in solar technology has really occurred because we got the business model. We had the right technology, and we also got the business model right. And I think that is the real opportunity when you bring together the thinking about what is the business model, when you can build on platforms that already have high coverage, for the way that the development can spark innovation and help innovation to start take off. So it's early in that pipeline. But then be thinking about what then are the systems that will support its own scale-up in the end without what continued investment from the UK or other donors. So the last slide is about the opportunity and the challenge moving forward. So we continue to be thinking about how do we use science to inform development, how do we keep on top of the new innovations that are happening, and assess their potential application to the development challenges that we face. And we have some very strong partnerships, including with Innovate UK, in creating mechanisms to support entrance into that pipeline of new technologies. There's one initiative that's happening as we speak within DFID, which I think is quite fun, where we've put in some initial investments around the development of a few different technologies, and this is work that we're doing with IDS and the University of Sussex. And then we're saying to country offices in DFID, okay, are any of these technologies of interest to you? And supporting partnerships between the innovators and different country offices say, well, let's see if there's an opportunity to start piloting these technologies. And so I don't know if you can see how clearly you can see the photos. The first one on the left is a hybrid airship, which uses alternative energy sources. And the potential of this is to expand access and be able to deliver commodities to areas that have very weak infrastructure. And this is airships, a new generation of airships that require one pilot and one person to load and unload cargo that could be transported. The second one is in response to the challenge that we face often of water pumps not being adequately maintained, that they break down, and so you have challenges in continued supply of clean water. So this is again using a mobile technology where people can essentially get credit, buy credit from somebody with an M-Pesa account to get to access clean water. And so this is the chip. It's a bit like an Oyster card. And it can work offline as well as online. So it's quite advanced. But essentially you can use that. So these people you can't quite see will hold this chip with credit up to that, just above that red pipe, and you can get, it will buy you basically a gallon of clean water or some volume of clean water. So it's a way, but you can set up a business. So there's a business model around this where women can have a business of supporting, of selling this credit at very low margins in terms of profit, but they have the incentive then to maintain that pump and make sure it works. What I'm also excited about in relation to this is we can also track clean water use. So if you want to say, well, how much are communities accessing clean water? What are our investments leading to? We can also use the data that comes from this to get better insights in terms of what are the results that we're achieving from our development investments. And then the last one on the right is on drones. And we have been doing some piloting, for example, of what is the potential to use drones in emergency situations or to deliver medical supplies to very remote medical facilities. And so we don't know yet what the country offices are picking out of these technologies. They also have options of testing blockchain. But it's one of the ways that we're trying to think about how do we support innovation, but also then how do we strengthen that pathway to testing those innovations in the realities of delivering development across our different country offices. So with that, I get on to my conclusions that science and innovation is crucial for development. And UK ODA is committed to supporting research, particularly high quality, very problem focused research and innovation. I've given you a flavour, I hope, of some of the impacts that are achieved through this work. There are many, and it was hard to write this talk because their choice was very big. And this work is very much conducted in partnership with academia and the public and private sector. In particular, we're increasingly investing in and drawing upon digital and big data and new technologies and thinking about how can we use this not only to achieve scale but also then to expand out once we do achieve scale in one area. The challenge, but what remains important, is to ensure that can maintain flexibility in the way that we're supporting research, in the way that we're making investments. So if new opportunities arise or if new crises hit us, we are able to respond very flexibly and in an agile way to address the new challenges as they emerge. Thank you.